And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Take one of America's premier foundations, mix in a festival to celebrate the centennial of one of America's greatest national parks, then sprinkle lightly with a touch of folly, and what do you get? Today's show, Fools, Foundations, and Festivals, coming right up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
We're approaching one of America's favorite weekends. It's time to go on Daylight Savings Time. Quite a week of contrasts, as in parts of the planet, people had the sun stolen by a total eclipse. While here now, we await that magic moment always on a Sunday evening, when it's like a gift. The sun just keeps on shining when the day before it was dark. It's a sign of better times ahead, and Lord knows we need some better days. It's been a tough spell around the planet, not so much from the weather as it has been from trying to determine which way the wind is blowing. The great war on terror isn't so great anymore. And I'll stop right there politically, as quite frankly, we've got a lot of good show coming up, and it's time to tell you what's coming. Fools, Foundations, and Festivals. That's what's coming. In segment 3, we talk with Billy Parrish, who is right in the thick of college issues. As Time Magazine provides a special edition on global warming with the headline, "Be Worried, Be Very Worried," it's good to know what's happening on campuses these days. For our Foundations segment, which follows the news, we'll be talking with a new executive director of the ubiquitous Surfrider Foundation about what they do and where the tides are taking them as they focus their mission on the waves and beaches where most people meet their oceans. And in segment 2, our festival segment, we talk with Dan Pushkar about the 100th anniversary of one of America's greatest cultural meccas, Mesa Verde National Park. So we get this springtime extravaganza rolling as soon as we hear what's up with this week's Earth News. So first, the news. This week's Wild Side News quote of the week. Bottom trawling is like trying to capture songbirds in a forest with bulldozers. This was the wisdom of Arlo Hemphill, Conservation International's Manager of Marine Strategy, commenting on the upside of a requested moratorium on deep-sea trawling, issued by the European Union during a UN-sponsored environmental conference in Brazil. At the same event, the island nation of Kiribati announced the creation of a vast protected area around the Phoenix Islands, located halfway between Fiji and Hawaii. Kiribati's president, Anote Tong, added his wisdom as well with, "If the coral and reefs are protected, then the fish will thrive and grow and bring us benefit." Whether or not the rest of the conference will ratify the ban on bottom trawling is yet to be determined. Environmentalists praise the two moves as indicative of a growing trend toward protecting the world's oceans. In a somewhat related move, that up-again, down-again, up-again bill to allow oil drilling in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, well, Republican leader John Bonner thinks it will have a tough time being approved when voted on as part of the budget bill. Following the Senate's inclusion of granting leases for drilling in their budget bill, which was passed by the Senate, 24 House Republicans announced that they could not support a budget bill that approved drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. Instead, they are planning to introduce legislation to help America kickstart improved hopes for energy independence within the next 10 years. And the California congressman, who never seemed to be able to find an environmental protection law he could not aggressively oppose, finds himself in a tough race for re-election. Yes, Representative Richard Pombo, the poster child of environmental indifference, who wears his cowboy hat and boots to give him that tough guy look, is appearing now in ads and in person, sans hat and boots, and trying to appear like more of an environmentalist to better match his changing constituency. Amazingly, even Republicans are working for his departure from the sacred halls of Congress. His most ardent opponent is none other than moderate Republican Pete McCloskey, who moved into Pombo's district specifically to challenge him for the seat. McCloskey, who was one of the authors of the Endangered Species Act, moved into the district after failing to enlist an effective Republican contender to unseat Pombo. Of course, Pombo's loyal opponents are happy to see such challenges. Roger Schleicheson, president of Defenders of Wildlife, shared the sentiments of McCloskey as he stated recently, "Getting rid of him would be the best thing politically that could happen to us in the November election." Pombo's troubles are not limited to his questionable environmental ethics. He also suffers from just plain ethics, as he has been implicated as one of the lawmakers who was taking money from Jack Abramoff, the high-powered lobbyist who was just sentenced to over 5 years in prison for just one of his illegal schemes. With so much bad news on the environmental front, it's always refreshing to hear that occasional feel-good story. And that's the news. And a few announcements. Global warming. A month back, the Wildside News had as its lead story, "Global warming, it's real." Well, apparently that idea is gaining some great allies as this week, the Ad Council, Environmental Defense, and Ogilvy & Mather, one of the world's leading advertising agencies, teamed up to produce and distribute on mainstream media a series of PSAs about global warming. And it sure makes a difference when the really big media people get involved. I'll be playing one audio spot between each segment produced by this coalition to give you a sense of how our message is now being promoted by the majors. And I also have links to the TV spots on today's show page. I guarantee you, you will be impressed when you see how the threat of global warming is handled. It's encouraging to see these issues finally breaking through the ice of the mainstream media. It's good to have them working with us directly for a change. Thanks. Our first feature was conducted via a cell phone while the guest was driving back up from Tijuana, so bear with me a bit on the sound. Seems everyone has heard of the Surf Rider Foundation at some time or another. It's a truly romantic moniker for a global endeavor to focus on that area where the land and the oceans collide, known as the surf. There's a huge community of people who head out in the mornings early and head out to the coasts, actually all over the world, to try to catch the big wave and take it for a ride to wherever it goes. They're known as the surfers, and historically, they're a rather free-form group of people. They span the spectrum from young to very old. And a number of years ago, they began to organize for a whole lot of reasons. One, because they were losing their places to surf. And out of that grew an organization called SurfRider.org. Joining us now is the new executive director of SurfRider.org, the Surf Rider Foundation, Jim Moriarty. Jim, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about Surf Rider Foundation and how it began.
Great story. There's actually a story before the beginning of the guys that started it were doing some Baja relief to some people down there that needed relief, so they brought clothes and all different kinds of things down to people in Baja. But where they really started to organize and what later became the Surf Rider Foundation was the fact that they all lived in and around Malibu. And one day there was literally a bulldozer changing the river foundation coming out to the coast at First Point Malibu, which is among the most classic surf spots in the world. It's featured in, you know, a whole lot of very corny movies. And there's a bulldozer literally ruining the beach, and three people, it's the classic story that three people just, you know, thought this is not acceptable. They're going to ruin, you know, a resource here that we view as incredibly important and very valuable to us. And they not only thought that, but then they put their thoughts into actions and they started to interact with the city councils and all the right people and change the course of Malibu. And to this day, you know, their work at First Point Malibu stands. So that from that point on, Surf Rider Foundation essentially became a group of coastal enthusiasts. So it's not necessarily surfers. It's people that live in and around the coast that essentially value that and act on that thought and on those needs. We're kind of emissaries or advocates for coastal resources.
Right. You've expanded out now, and you're very active in a whole series of actions and concerns all over the world now. As a matter of fact, I think you have, what, 50,000 members. Why don't you tell me about your membership?
The membership in the United States is around 52,000. It's doubled in probably the last 5-6 years. One of the most interesting aspects of our membership, though, that I've found is the fact that people internationally essentially steal or take our logo and start their own Surfrider foundations everywhere without our permission. So we now today have representation, legal affiliates in Australia, Brazil, Japan, and Europe. And every single one of those started without our permission. There's a great compliment in that, you know, that people essentially see your idea as something that maybe is similar to freedom or something that transfers regions. It's not a Southern California phenomenon. It's an issue everywhere all over the world. The people essentially live along the coast, and they say, okay, we need to protect this. It's a great asset. It's a great part of our lives.
That's a great story. I wasn't aware of that. People just kind of adopt you.
Yeah, and we actually, it got so out of hand that 7 years ago we put a moratorium on international expansion because we just didn't have the manpower or staffing or funding to manage that. And this year, for the first time, matter of fact, in the last probably 5 months, we lifted the moratorium, and we've also just in the last 30 days hired our first international staffer to manage that. And this year we expect to have 6 international chapters pop up in Argentina, 2 in Costa Rica, 2 in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Well, define what the mission is. It really embraces a whole spectrum of sustainability and a healthy planet.
The mission is probably the lightning rod that everyone around Surfrider agrees on. And from, you know, as you get further into details, people start to disagree on different things. But it can really be brought down to a very small number of words. And it's essentially protecting ocean waves and beaches. And the real emphasis on it is really protecting waves and beaches. And there's a couple of reasons for, you know, why I've distilled it down to those words. First of all, we're not really an ocean group. We're not a deep blue group like Ocean Conservancy and other groups. And we're also not a green group like Sierra Club, meaning that we don't deal inland very far. We really try to stay as much as we can right along the coast. That's really our sweet spot. So as an example, we do get involved in things like seawalls. We get involved in things like artificial reefs. We get involved in water quality. Today's a perfect example. I was supposed to go down and tour the Tijuana watershed with Wild Coast, and it's been raining all night and raining all day. And you know, I basically just made the decision that the Tijuana watershed is in such bad shape that even a tour during the rain, after a couple of days of rain, is just going to be horrible.
Yes, it would be.
So, but that's the kind of issue that we would get involved in.
Mm-hmm. You're also trying to protect the access to the oceans for the populace in general.
Absolutely. Yeah, we view, you know, and this is, as I said, some people have different views, and this is one of those issues where some people have different views on this. You know, I believe the statistic is that the coast of Maine, 40% of the coast of Maine is inaccessible. And on the West Coast here in California, pretty much most of California and most of the West Coast, you can access. Just the idea of going to the beach, you can just go to the beach. You can park. You really don't have to pay for parking. There's certain places that you have to pay for, like, preferred access. But you can just access the beach, but that's not the case on the East Coast. I've been to meetings where kids have been arrested. Like, when I say kids, I mean like 10 or 11-year-olds have been written up for multi-hundred-dollar tickets and fines because they literally paddled into waves in front of private clubs on Long Island. So
wow.
They didn't even walk on the sand. they were in the ocean, and
so
they're receiving, you know, large tickets.
A sense of ownership out a distance away from the shoreline.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. So as an example, we had a recent victory in Rockaway Beach, which is again on Long Island, and it was a law from the 1850s where no one paid attention to it until a new mayor came in and decided that he needed more revenue sources and read the laws that existed. And there was one from the 1850s that essentially talked about accessing the beach with flotation devices. This was well before there was any surfing in the area. And the mayor started, you know, writing out, again, very high fines for people that were just walking around with boogie boards and surfboards and other things, and even just walking on the beach. And so we fought that and overturned it. And so we do believe very strongly that people should just be able to access the beach.
I think that's just such a powerful thing. It's something we take for granted here in California.
Yeah.
It's extraordinarily powerful in terms of what it adds to our life. You also are working on larger global issues. I mean, we're talking about global warming now. We're talking about coastal pollution. You're very active in those realms. Many of your members are active in monitoring water quality at the coasts.
Yeah, about, I don't know when it started, maybe 10 years ago, we had the idea of starting a volunteer grassroots water quality network. So we did that, and it's today you can access it at rashguard.org. But we're actually in the process of taking a step back, and internally we're assessing how important that is and where the data can come from. So right now we're actually talking with there's about a dozen academic leaders dealing with coastal water quality as part of their life's work. And we've engaged the majority of them now, and we are contemplating a nationwide and then worldwide water quality network, which would have kind of an optimized algorithm, which would take inputs from municipal testing, from volunteer testing, from all different types of local precipitation impacts, topographical, tidal, surges, sun, and essentially coming up with an algorithm that we would almost take water quality away from what it is today, which is essentially letting people know how bad it was yesterday. There's really nowhere in the world that can tell you how bad it is right now. Real-time water quality monitoring for a lot of the bacteria just does not exist. But we're going to be working with a lot of academic institutions to be on the front end of the hardware to do that, but then also to take it from how bad it was yesterday to how bad it is right now, and even to the point of forecasting water pollution and water quality levels and how it will be tomorrow.
That is very progressive.
This is one of those surfer angles that, you know, the surfers are the canaries in the coal mine. We are literally out there duck diving underwater, and then, you know, you fast forward a year later and somebody's getting their lymph nodes removed, and it's not fun.
Yeah, that's for sure. I'm going to kind of switch the discussion here a little bit because you're the new executive director. You've been
right
with them, with the Surfrider, since about 6 months, is it?
You know, it's about 8, but
8 months?
6-8 is probably not that different.
Close enough. Some people would say that you don't fit the normal sort of quote-unquote, and as you said, you're not necessarily an environmental group, but people consider you part of the environmental organizations. But you have a unique background. First of all, you weren't born on the coast. Secondly, you come from a corporate background. Third, I believe it's no secret that you consider yourself a Republican, and all of that's just fine. But I think that's exciting, actually. Where's the crossover here between that sort of background and your mission now, personally, and then for surfrider.org?
Yeah, I think it's a logical question, and it's one that I actually had myself as I started interacting with the board. The first couple of times I talked to them, I literally told them that I'm not their man. I literally said that I'm not, you know, a policy wonk. I'm not a person who, you know, volunteers his time in this specific kind of area. I volunteer my time, you know, mentoring high school students and things like that. But what I learned through the process, through the interview process was that they were really looking for was someone who could take the values and the brand of coastal stewardship and environmental protection and bring it into the 21st, which is absolutely where I live. I mean, for the last 20 years, I've been building and working alongside some of the most brilliant minds in technology, taking kind of the world is flat thinking and applying it to the coastal environment, and then marrying that with my own personal love of action sports and board sports, makes a lot of sense once you get closer to it.
So how do you hope to transform and advance the Surfrider Foundation's mission, bringing your skills to the challenge?
Well, one of the things that you mentioned was the Republican angle, and I'm always intrigued that people pick up on that, because to me it doesn't matter. I think so many times we try to oversimplify and look at the world with binary eyes. Oh, that's a Republican issue. Oh, that's a Democrat issue. There's no such thing as a pro-life Democrat. Well, of course there are. You know, many of my friends are pro-life Democrats. And from my perspective, one of the ways that Surfrider needs to reach out to, needs to succeed, regardless of being right, we need to succeed. The way that we need to succeed is with what I'm calling a Big Ten approach. I don't care if you surf. I don't care if you're Republican or Democrat. I don't care if you're 10 years old or 100 years old. We can't have these kind of filters on people that we let into a movement that says, let's protect the coast. So it doesn't matter to me what someone's religious affiliation is or their political affiliation. I'm looking for people that value what's happening at the coast and will act on that, on those instincts and on those interests. So as you look at the people that make up the Surfrider Foundation, we did a very unscientific, quick snapshot during the last political election. It was 50-50, 50% Republican, 50% Democrat. That, to me, makes total sense. So to answer your question, one way that I'm going to impact the organization is to promote a Big Ten approach and to really reach out across political spectrum, across all the various self-imposed filters, and tell everyone that lives along the coast, you need to get involved and protect this, or it will be gone. Secondly, I referenced earlier in the book, The World is Flat. I mean, the world is flat. You know, you pick up the phone and you change your cell phone provider and you're talking to someone in Argentina or Bangalore. That's just life. It's not something that is either right or wrong. It just is. So my mentality is a little bit, the world is flat. Get over with it. Deal with it. And from my perspective, you need to take a step back and say, in our world of blogs and 24-hour media and wireless access and dead zones the size of Rhode Island off the coast of Louisiana, you know, in the world that we live in today with all the various issues, how can we make an impact on the coast? And from my perspective, one of the ways we need to do that is treat the intelligence that we can access as an asset. If you look at Google, Google isn't a technology company. They're a company that is all about delivering access to information. And to some degree, we are a similar thing. We need to have people in Chile who are dealing with gross polluting paper mills be able to go onto whatever search engine or whatever internet access they have and be able to find information on how they can organize and what the issues are without ever picking up the phone and talking to us, because we're not probably going to answer the phone and talk to them. We just don't have the staff. We'll never have the staff to talk to people in Indonesia, but we do have the ability to put intelligence out there in the form of case studies, and we can translate into different languages. We can do a lot of different things that scale in a non-traditional environmental organization way. And so the way that I'm going to have an impact on this organization is I'm really going to bring it from, in my opinion, from the last century to this century by embracing tools like the one that you're using right now. I mean, I do a radio interview on other radio shows, and people have to be listening to the radio live. And on your show, it can essentially be accessed, I'm guessing, anytime, and podcasting and things like that. So this is a perfect example of it.
It's magic. It serves us so well. We need to embrace this and utilize it. And it's so easy. The interesting thing is that it's so doable, and I appreciate that. Let's talk a little bit personally here, because it really does. There is this relationship that we have with the oceans, with the waves, and it is very personal. Talk to me, because I think that's also where there is this crossover, where it doesn't matter who you are, what your background is. There is this human connection with nature, and the oceans have a very special place for many, many people. When they come there, something happens.
Right.
From your perspective, when all these people that you're working with and talking with, give us a sense of what you think is the basis of that personal connection.
Well, during the interview process, I was asked the question, are you an environmentalist? And I said, every surfer is an environmentalist. And we got into a discussion on that. And essentially there was a thought process that not every surfer is an environmentalist. And I said, you know, from my perspective, anyone who goes to the beach has to be impacted at some level at the beach. It's just like if you go into Yosemite, you're impacted by what you see in some way. In my opinion, the deeper you go into the environment, the more you're impacted by it, or the more that you have the potential to be impacted by it. I was talking to Yvonne Chouinard, founder of Patagonia, about this, and, you know, the deeper that they went into Yosemite in the early days of rock climbing, when they were smashing the rocks with pitons, they understood, okay, we're ruining the environment that we love. And so the mountaineering and alpinists literally transferred from that kind of sport to something that is incredibly environmental because they're impacted by it. In my opinion, the people that, you know, divers or snorkelers or people that are literally submerged in the elements along the ocean, surfers and boogie boarders and body surfers, those people understand that the environment, the fragility of the environment, because they see a dolphin go by, they see, you know, sea lions, they step on, you know, rays. It's different than if you're in a boat, you know, a fishing boat or something, and you're just looking down at it all. You're literally in it. So in my opinion, there is a very, very deep connection that surfers and other people that are literally in the ocean have with the environment. And it's actually really hard for me to understand how someone wouldn't be impacted by that.
Mm-hmm. As you're talking now to a broad spectrum of people literally around the world, what are things that they should be aware of and thinking about as it relates to the waves and the beaches?
Well, I think in the end it comes down to just almost an appreciation for the natural forces at work and for keeping them that way. So essentially, if you build a house too close to the beach, it will be taken down over time by the ocean. If you build a wall, the same thing. And when you try to kind of add your own footprint into nature's footprint, you're essentially going to lose eventually. And it kind of goes back to, you know, 2,000 years. The Bible was written about, you know, the wise man built his house upon the rock. And still here we are in 2006. And in Solana Beach, my hometown, people are building their house upon the sand. And the walls are coming tumbling down. I mean, it's just happening. I think simple things like that, just the knowledge of, okay, these waves, you know, rise, it's like the tsunamis or the floods and Katrina and all those other things. Nature has a cyclical force, and that force is very, very strong. So as you look at places like Europe and the coast of Europe where they have zones that you cannot build houses close to the coast, I mean, that's just kind of logical sense. I think the other thing that makes a lot of sense is you're down in Central America and other places is just the simple need to take measures to contain your trash. I mean, with the advent and explosion of plastics, if you throw the plastics into the river or into the coast, you're going to be causing damage eventually. And A, if you see those kinds of things, you just pick them up. But B, you should kind of work to figure out a solution so that doesn't happen.
Very good. Jim, for people who want to learn more about Surf Rider Foundation, what's the best way to do so?
Go to surfrider.org, and I would encourage you to actually find your local chapter. If you live near the coast, anywhere in the United States and increasingly around the world, there's usually a group of people that are pretty like-minded, and they're not, you know, Jeff Spicoli surfers. They're soccer moms, they're kids, they're seniors. They cross all the political spectrum. And that's one of the most encouraging things that I've seen as I've traveled to most of the chapters in our United States. We have 64 chapters. Surf Rider is you. Surf Rider is basically people that live at the coast. And I would rather people actually get engaged and with their local chapter than even join the national organization. But that said, we'd love for you to join. You can go to surfrider.org and join our organization.
Jim Moriarty, new executive director of Surf Rider Foundation, I want to thank you so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thanks so much.
From the surf of sunny California, we're heading up to the high mesas of Colorado to one of America's premier cultural meccas known as Mesa Verde. There's a big celebration occurring this year, and you'll learn more about that and more when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Everywhere we go these days, people are talking about uncovering the truth of our nation. It's a deep, rich legacy, much of which was written long before formalized systems of democracy were in place. Long before Westerners knew of the grand American lands, indigenous civilizations flourished. As the truth comes out, someday the truth about the high culture of the Anasazi may give us a greater sense of our land and its legacy. In just a moment, we travel to an early American Mecca, high atop a mesa, when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. A number of years back, I had the great pleasure of traveling around over the span of 2 years, serving as the artist in residence in some of America's grandest national parks: Redwood, Arches, Canyonlands, Yellowstone, Colorado National Monument. But one stands out as a truly profound experience, living high atop a mesa in Colorado, getting to see, draw, and paint the expressions of a grand people who built their Mecca high in the hollows of the sheer cliffs of Mesa Verde. This is the 100th anniversary of the founding of Mesa Verde National Park. It's a very early addition to the park system. And joining us to talk about that is Dan Pushkar, who is the centennial coordinator for this event. Daniel, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you very much, Sydney.
Dan, first of all, how long have you been at Mesa Verde?
I've been at Mesa Verde for about a year now.
Why was it that you wanted to be at Mesa Verde?
My own training, actually. I was in school for a very long time as a historian and anthropologist. And it just so happens that Mesa Verde is the only national park that we have really devoted to preserving the works of humankind and cultural resources as opposed to natural ones. So it just so happens this place is a very good fit for me.
And I guess I should pronounce this. You're saying Verde.
Well, I'll tell you, they say it all sorts of different ways.
I have heard
Mesa Verde.
Mm-hmm.
I have heard Mesa Verde. And then there are others who are far better at a Spanish accent than I can, who can actually probably say it the way the Spanish intended. But I will tell you something I learned coming to Western Colorado. If you talk to anyone around here, it is always Mesa Verde.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. The locals in Cortez, Durango, Dolores, all the nearby towns, Mesa Verde.
Never heard that before.
I hadn't either.
Mm-hmm. Dan, give us a little history of Mesa Verde.
Well, Mesa Verde itself was first occupied by humans, as far as we know, somewhere a good 1,500 years ago. It was back in around 500 A.D. that you had the first people, ancestral Puebloans, as we would call them now, but previously you might have heard the term Anasazi. It was around 500 A.D. that they moved up into these hills and then continued to live here until almost 1300.
Mm.
Those were the first people to come in and really start to build, and it's their cliff dwellings in particular, those that were built in the 1200s, that people most come to see now. For a long time then, after the ancestral Puebloans left, a few people knew about this place, of course. The Navajo and the Utes, for a time, both occupied these hills. But it was in the 1880s that white settlers moving west first began to come into the hills.
And that actually led to its ultimately becoming a national park. What led to that progression?
Well, you had a couple of key players for sure. On the one hand, the band of brothers, literally, who first made their way into the hills and found most of the cliff dwellings, the Wetherill brothers were just a couple of ranchers down in the nearby town of Mancos. And they, of course, told all their friends about it, and word started to leak out around Colorado Territory, the Colorado State around then. And it was not very long after that that a sort of world-famous explorer by the name of Gustav Nordenskjöld, suffering from tuberculosis, came to the southwest of the United States, and he came and did some of the first real excavations of these cliff dwellings. Well, now you've got a little bit more attention paid to this place. Nordenskjöld himself wrote a book about Mesa Verde, the first one ever done, and was publishing it not only in English, but in Swedish. People really started paying attention to this. I'll tell you, though, it first came to the national level with the idea of being a national park based on the efforts of a lot of local women around Mesa Verde. It was a group of women led by people like Virginia McClurg and Lucy Peabody who got people together and said, you know what, this thing in our backyard, this is something that we have never seen before. We're not sure where else we'd ever see it, and we need to make sure that our grandchildren and their grandchildren get to see it themselves.
Truly a visionary understanding of its importance.
I would say so. They were really a really, really impressive group of people who, I must say, all got around the idea that this has to be preserved. Some of them thought it should be a state park, others a national park. There were all sorts of details that they might have been able to question and ask each other about. But when it came to just preserving this place, everybody was in agreement.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the Anasazi culture and ultimately the Puebloan cultures that became the people of Mesa Verde. What can you tell us about them and their place in the Southwest and the larger realms of American history, and actually Mesoamerican history as well?
Well, this was a group of people that had many strong traditions about what their place in the world was. We hear today the Pueblo people tell us about how it was that they came through a series of different worlds, actually, under the ground to eventually come up into the world that we're at now. Where they came up and where they started as a people in this world, there's actually some disagreement as to where that might be. But eventually, some of those people migrating as hunter-gatherers made their way around what's today the Four Corners area. And it was after many, many years of being hunter-gatherers by around the 500s that many changed the way they were going to be doing business. Stopped migrating as much and started to put down structures. At first, what they were building were pit houses, things largely made out of mud and sticks, really, large branches. It took several hundred years of getting better and better at masonry techniques and improving their architecture so that eventually, in and around 1200, you had incredible stonemasons who could create the kinds of buildings that we have here today. This was a rich culture. It had its own spirituality, religion, its own ways of farming and building, and we're really lucky that they left us such a monument to their culture.
Having spent time there and had the chance to really wander around the many, many sites that exist there, one of the things that really struck me was the fact that these were people who had an extraordinary sense of design. The architecture itself is stunning and magical and powerful. And then another element on top of that, which I find so absolutely fascinating, is the extraordinary level of artistry that was applied to so many of their living items. I think that's an extraordinary story that I hope in time will be told even in a more rich and powerful way, because they were master artisans. I know that you literally have a collection of millions of artifacts. Have you had a chance to wander through some of those collections?
I've wandered through quite a bit. You're absolutely right. They had incredible artistry and design. It's one of those things when I know I've given tours to groups, I've often gotten questions about whether or not these people, it was a very difficult life for them. And I have to have them turn around and look at these dwellings and look at the petroglyph art and the plaster art that's around, and it just begs the question, could a group struggling for survival make this?
Right.
Probably not. This is a group that had time for all sorts of things, including the arts. I've been able to see a great many of the things that they've created. You're right, it is in the millions. Just in our research facilities alone, we have well over 3 million artifacts. And those are the ones that have been dug out of the ground, or sometimes found on top of the ground, and have been taken into our labs. That's not to say there aren't other collections around the world. And then, of course, a number of things that, well, we'll never know where they went. In the early years of the park, as you might imagine, before you could have a really strong ranger presence, there was a good amount of vandalism and looting going on. There are a lot of pieces from Mesa Verde that we don't have access to, may never have, but we're fortunate to have so much.
The people of Mesa Verde crafted some very unique items, particularly the utilitarian objects, things they used for cooking and eating. Tell me some that stand out in your mind.
Well, for me, I guess I have always been impressed by their different kinds of tools. On the one hand, you just can shape a stick to make it easier for digging. On the other hand, we've seen evidence of some of the axes that they have made. By climbing down off of the mesa, going down to the rivers, which carry harder stones, bringing them back up into the mesa, and sharpening these harder stones on the sandstone so that they could create axes to cut down trees, whether that was for building or for firewood, things like that. Just some amazing tools, the kinds of things I know myself, I wonder if I would have been able to create in the same kind of way. But you also have a lot of things that they use domestically that are just wonderful. Some of their pottery, I've got to tell you, the pottery that was made back in the 1200s, the classic black on white, is just exquisite. All of the different details made within it, and the pottery is not all made the same way either. Sometimes you'll just take a piece of clay and be able to mold it into one piece of it, really exquisite bowls or mugs and things like that. Other times you'll have corrugated ware when the people who were making the pottery would take different strips of clay and build on top of one another to make a nice big jar that they could keep their water in and things like that. We've also here at the park found amazing jewelry that's made not only of local things, but we have found shells, seashells, that really can only come from places around Baja California, for example. We wonder, what kind of trade networks must have existed for these people so that they could have these beautiful shells and then make jewelry out of them? Wonderful, wonderful artistic and design culture that was here.
One of the most fascinating designs that were utilized by the Mesa Verde people were these mugs that literally are handled mugs.
Yes, they are.
You could go into a Starbucks today, and if you saw one, you'd say, oh, that's a Starbucks mug. They're gorgeous, big-handled mugs. Tell us a little bit about that, because I think that's somewhat unique to Mesa Verde.
It is rather unique, and it's something unique to a specific time in their culture as well. We don't really see many mugs earlier than the late 1100s. It's something that really marks that time period of settlement here at Mesa Verde. And you're right, they are absolutely exquisite, nice big-handled mugs that we found all over the place. But I can tell you that in one site, a place that we now call Mug House, we found 3 to 5 of these held together on a nice little rope hanging from the ceiling of one of the rooms. I don't know if that was just a really great storage space or based on all of the different real artistry that went into painting these mugs, whether this was just considered a decoration. But we do here today have Mug House because it really was something that was special about that time in the ancestral Puebloan's history and special to that place.
I hope sometime in the future I have the opportunity to visit Mesa Verde again and actually visit the collections. One of the fascinations that I have is to try to imagine how many different objects. I realize you can't answer this, but it's my fascination, so I'm just going to talk about it.
Okay.
But I always try to imagine, these are very complex people who survived for hundreds and hundreds of years there. And as you say, the artifacts number in the millions. their lifestyle was very complex. The tools, the clothing, the sandals, the mats, the cooking utensils, the, you know, I always try to imagine, and as a matter of fact, I'm trying to, at some point here, do a painting that would indicate the complexity of life, for example, inside one of the rooms. I would have to assume that it was filled with objects, and they were beautiful objects, and then another layer on top of that is the fact that the walls, in many cases, inside these individual rooms were stuccoed, and that the interior walls were stuccoed, and oftentimes there were beautiful designs applied to the walls. Give a sense of what it may have been like living inside one of those rooms. Have you had a chance to really think about the complexity of the artifacts that might make up a typical family's dwelling?
Oh, you bet. And you're right. There were so many different things, from tools to blankets to sandals to other kinds of clothing, mugs and pottery, sometimes even nice little holders to set your pottery on, little rings that you could use. There was an amazing amount of stuff here. And it's not just those objects, but it's what you fit them in. Now, it's true that a lot of the rooms here did have stuccoed sides to them. Some of them were plastered, not all. But what we have found that's left are beautiful colors, reds and browns and blacks and all sorts of different colors that went into these plasters that would then go up on interior and exterior walls. There are times, my office is not too far from one of our larger cliff-dwelling spruce tree houses. There are times I look down there, and right now, most of it looks very beige. But it really is worth wondering, how colorful was it back then?
Right.
How many different reds and whites and browns were part of this tableau, as opposed to now, when so much of that plaster really has fallen off?
Exactly right. And that's one of the things that I always like to emphasize, is that people, when looking at these, should really put the walls back up. And try to imagine a very advanced culture with an extraordinary sense of artistry. How many people would you estimate have lived there at any particular time?
At the height of the civilization here, the estimates that are usually suggested are probably between 3,000 and 5,000 people. And on top of that, that number on the mesa itself, in the Montezuma Valley down below, where some of our present-day towns are, you may very well have had about 30,000 people there. I can tell you right now, that is a higher number than lives on Mesa Verde and in that valley today.
Mm-hmm.
It was a much more populated area than it is right now. What the exact number was, it's something I'm not sure we'll ever know.
Mm-hmm.
But probably up here on the mesa in around 1,200, 3,000-5,000 people.
That's extraordinary. Any idea why they chose this location?
Well, it's a great location for a lot of reasons. You do have really good soil up here on the mesa top. In fact, over many, many hundreds of thousands of years, it has blown over from the southwest. And you really have very good soil up here on the top of the mesa, far better, actually, than you have down below in the valleys. It would have been a little bit difficult for water in that you don't have a river coming right through. It is the top of a mesa. But it also just so happens that there are springs, steep springs, water coming out of the sides of the cliffs that would have been very good for keeping people hydrated and using a bit in their dry land farming. It may have just been also nice because you've got really incredible views up here. I don't know if you know that, but we really like our views.
They are extraordinary. Now, for a visitor who's coming up this year, which is your centennial year, and we're going to talk about some of the events coming up, let's talk about their experience. How long should they plan? I know it's quite a long drive up and down. There's also places to stay and things to see. Give us a perspective on that.
Well, you're right. It is a long drive. I live up here on the mesa, and anytime I want to go to the supermarket, I've got a 40-minute drive to get down to a Cortez or Mancos as a town. Mesa Verde is the kind of place that we would recommend people can spend half a day, people can spend 3-4 days. It really is what you want to make of it. We have a number of different cliff dwellings that you can just walk into on your own. It's self-guided. We have others like Cliff Palace, Balcony House, and Longhouse, where you can take hour or hour and a half long tours with a ranger who can show you much more about the intricacies of the site. We have a lot of hiking trails that not only just get to experience what is a rather incredible natural world that we have here, but we've got things like, for example, the Petroglyph Point Trail. It's a 2.8-mile trail where you get to really go by some incredible rock art that was made hundreds and hundreds of years ago. We have a lot to do here at this park, and it certainly can be a half day. In a half day, you could probably do a hike and go to Cliff Palace. You spend a few more days, trust me, we'll keep you busy.
How about accommodations?
As far as accommodations are concerned, up here within the park, there is one hotel, the Farview Lodge. We also have one of the largest campgrounds in the National Park Service, and it is found about 5 minutes into the park itself from the entrance station. And I must say, we have plenty of room in that regard. Usually during the summer, there's only one day of the year, around July 4th, that the campground ever completely fills. It's more than 300 empty spaces.
That's fabulous. And then one thing that you do have as well is an extraordinary pristine silence at times.
Oh, yes.
That is
especially
rare.
During the winter. I'll tell you, I've been living here for a while now, and in the winters, when you only have two or three visitors a day, because, of course, our park is open year-round, it's incredibly quiet. But it's also true that at the end of a long day in the summer, especially if you want to, say, camp down at the Moorfield Campground, as the sun starts to go down over the ridge nearby you, it's a beautiful, calm place.
Well, now, there's a lot coming up to celebrate Mesa Verde, which is an extraordinary place. Dan, give us a sense of some of the activities that are planned this year, 2006, the 100th anniversary of Mesa Verde.
Well, we have a number of different kinds of events scheduled. On the one hand, we have very special day celebrations. We had our kickoff to the centennial this past December 8th, where we actually took the time to illuminate with lanterns several of our cliff dwellings, including Cliff Palace and Spruce Tree House. It was the kind of night where you got to sit back from across a canyon, look over and say, maybe that's what it looked like when people had their campfires inside that cliff dwelling. Maybe that's how it got lit up when they were living here weaving, making their pottery. We've got other events like our actual birthday, which is coming up on June 29th of this year. We are having a four-day celebration, beginning with some wonderful programs and dinners. And, well, you know, it's a birthday. We're going to have cake. But there will also be a large trader's fair. We have a very strong connection with the Native American communities today whose ancestors used to live in these places. And a number of their great artisans are going to be coming up and demonstrating how to do all sorts of Native crafts for our visitors.
Oh, that'll be fascinating.
Oh, it'll be an incredible 4 days. And it's a great way, if you want to come in early, to stick around this area. I assure you, we'll have a fun 4th of July, too. Later in the year, we're also holding an alumni reunion for anyone who used to work here, who lived nearby, and anyone who feels that they're an alumni of Mesa Verde, that this place has had a strong connection on their lives. We'd love them to come up and reminisce with us. But beyond these kinds of special day events or a couple of day events, there are a number of ongoing programs that we are doing to celebrate this year, one of which is our Centennial Lecture Series. Practically every week we are having a different lecture about the history, geology, ecology, archaeology of Mesa Verde, past and present. We are also opening up parts of our backcountry this year to tours that have, well, in some cases never happened, and in others haven't happened for decades. For example, Mug House that I mentioned earlier. Mug House has never been open to visitors to go down and see it. It was only stabilized and excavated in the 1960s, and it is this year, for the first time ever, that we are offering ranger-guided tours of Mug House.
You're also having a number of really wonderful, unique I'm assuming they're weekend events, but for example, the Mesa Verde Centennial Photography Workshop, and then one that I'm very interested in, the Mesa Verde Archaeological Symposium. Tell us some details on those.
The photography workshops, we are having an esteemed professor, Gene Balzer from Northern Arizona University, will be coming up to give three different workshops, weekend workshops, during the course of the year. We have one coming up just in April and then others later in the fall. These are going to be weekends where participants are going to learn more about photographic techniques, but techniques that really apply to our landscape and the kinds of things that you find here at Mesa Verde, like our artifacts and our cliff dwellings, our canyons. It's going to be an incredible experience.
Is there a fee for that?
There is.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There is. These are weekend events. And we actually offer different kinds of rates depending on if we have someone local nearby who's planning on going home every night or if there's somebody who needs to stay in the park. We have a different rate for them.
Sure. And how much your archaeological symposium?
The archaeological symposium is held this year between May 3rd and 6th. The symposium is mainly located in the town of Toyoc, Colorado, which is actually a part of the Ute Tribal Park. Our neighbors here. It is 2 days of sessions on the last 100 years of archaeology that have been done here at Mesa Verde. As you may suspect, given that we are the kind of archaeological reserve that we are, a lot of the techniques that really today we talk about as being part of Southwest archaeology, they grew up here at Mesa Verde. So we're going to talk about that 100 years of archaeological research. Talk about what the next 100 years might look like. There were also included within the symposium the a number of field trips that are going to go all over this Four Corners area, into Mesa Verde, to places like Yucca House, which is a national monument as well, and a number of other really interesting archaeological sites. It's going to be phenomenal, and if any of your listeners and yourself are interested, you can register online for that conference as we speak at our website, which just happens to be www.mesaverde2006.org.
A great place to go to find out what's going on and register and find out a lot more. One of the things on that website is this apparently an image that was done where you lit up Cliff Palace with the lanterns. It's a phenomenal photograph, really telling. What can you say? It's an amazing place. Obviously, if people haven't been there, they will benefit greatly from a visit to Mesa Verde. It's a magical place and certainly plays an enormous role in trying to understand really the true legacy of America and the Americas and the Native American peoples who really found a balance with their environment. Dan Pushkar, I want to thank you for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much. I've been happy to be here.
For 600 years, they kept their people, their culture, and their environment alive. A few lessons to be learned as we realize that in less than 150 years of advancing technology, we are reaching the limits of our own existence. When we return, we learn about Fossil Fool's Day, a tribute to our folly, when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool block skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
General Motors announced that it must downsize its workforce by 125,000 workers. That corporate bubble is bursting, and some say it could have been avoided had carmakers heeded the many warnings over the last 35 years about oil and limits. But alas, it's a lot too late. Help celebrate Fossil Fools Day this Saturday and learn about it and more when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Everybody's talking about it, global warming. So many took it for granted. But apparently things are changing, and no place faster and more passionately than on college campuses across the nation. We head back east, and we meet Billy Parrish, who is turning a lot of minds around the vision that it's up to the current crop of college kids to take control of their destiny or be drowned in the ocean of change headed our way. As we look to this emerging new century, this is going to play out for different people in a lot of different ways. And I think the people who really are paying attention to some of these serious issues, particularly the global warming issue, are those who are younger than I am, because they're going to have to live with it for a lot longer, possibly even into the next century. Someone who's very involved in bringing that message forward to his very specific generation, that is to say people who are in college right now, is a gentleman named Billy Parrish. Billy, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks, Sydney.
You've been involved in environmental things for quite some time. Why don't you tell me how it is that these issues have become of such importance to you?
I've been a full-time student global warming organizer for almost 4 years. And I got interested in the work my junior year in high school at a school called the Mountain School in Vermont, which is a one-semester program on an organic farm in Vermont. And I grew up in New York City, so it was my first real introduction to nature and to environmental role models and a few books that really sort of raised my awareness about the problems that we face and that especially face young people.
What was it about that experience that stands out as a kind of a transitional moment for you?
One night I was reading a book called Ishmael by Daniel Quinn. In the book, he describes our civilization as a craft going off of a cliff. We believe that we're flying, and until people begin to look down and realize that our civilization is in free fall. And it was the first time that I really began to think about the fact that all of the things that I take for granted, you know, my family, the cities around us, the buildings that I live in, the food that I eat, all of that was really at risk with global warming and other environmental problems. And I began to, or it was in a way the beginning of my social conscience and my understanding of the impact that I was having on the rest of the world and how I could make a difference.
And then things began to evolve from there, and so you ultimately ended up going to Yale.
I did, partly because of the forestry school that Yale has, and the sort of strong social activism that was going on there. And I did 2.5 years of school there and ended up being co-chair of the Student Environmental Coalition and planned the first ever big Northeast regional conference on these issues and ended up dropping out to plan it and do follow-through. Thought I would only be out for a semester, but it's been 3.5 years and counting since then, so I really haven't looked back.
Do you plan to go back?
I don't. I don't think so.
Interesting. You found your mission.
I think I have.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly worthy of a life's work, and you know, I've met the best people I know. It's been an incredible challenge. And, no, I love the work, and it surely needs.
You're working primarily with college campus folks. Talk to me about how that interaction is going, what they're talking about, what do you think resonates with them, what doesn't work with them, and also what they think about the broader, older environmental community. Because at one point, for example, there were various environmentalists suggesting that environmentalism was dead. That was last year.
Mm-hmm.
Give us an update.
Well, I think it's interesting what's happened in the last 5 or so years within the student environmental movement, in that it has, I think, evolved very quickly, and students have begun moving away from recycling campaigns and river cleanup campaigns and increasingly are working on global warming, energy issues, and have begun to sort of identify global warming as the primary environmental and economic and societal challenge that we face. And other groups are beginning to get involved in it, too. We've begun to work more closely with other progressive organizations and farm-based groups and groups that are interested in addressing the root causes of war. So it really has become, I think, the hottest environmental issue on college campuses, and has begun to attract other types of organizations as well.
What's the word from the campuses? In other words, in the world out here, that we have this struggle between the red states and the blue states, and we're trying to achieve some sort of awareness on a broader scale that global warming and energy issues matter, and it is happening. We're starting to see this, for example, reflected in certain Congress people who are really championing these issues in a larger way. But when you go to a college campus, are you fighting those same battles yet? Do you have a loyal opposition who is standing again, kind of railing against your concepts?
There really is no opposition on college campuses. I think there is, in many cases, a lack of awareness, although that's improving a lot. But really the major challenge that we've faced in organizing with students is the administrators' sort of concerns about cost. You know, what will it cost the university to buy clean energy or to make their buildings efficient or to transform their transportation systems or how they invest their endowments? It's almost all price concerns. And so we developed a report that's called New Energy for Campuses, which is at our website, campusclimatechallenge.org. And that outlines about 40 case studies of best practices that colleges have done that have not only reduced emissions on the college campuses, but also saved the schools money. So we've really focused our messaging around the idea that this is an economic opportunity, that colleges can save huge amounts of money and reduce energy costs by taking on some of the efficiency and transportation and other types of energy and climate policies.
Do you find a fascination or an interest or a bit of energy in really seeing a technological resolution to these problems? You know, in many respects, although there's a cost factor to this, there's also an economic incentive to create these new technologies in the process, creating new companies, new industries, putting people back to work, creating greater efficiencies. What's kind of happening in those realms from the perspective of the college students?
I lived in North Dakota for 4 months at the end of last year because I'm fascinated with new clean energy technologies and the idea of really modernizing our economy based on, you know, ecological concerns, based on new, you know, clean technologies. And, you know, I think it's a huge opportunity for the whole country, but I think the Midwest actually is the area of the country that could benefit the most. They're farmers who, you know, could grow fuel and biofuels and create electricity through wind farms. There are a lot of sort of hollowed out Midwest industrial cities that could see a resurgence in jobs in clean tech industries. So I think it's a huge opportunity that right now we're frankly missing out on and are losing the race to many countries around the world in Europe and Asia and other places. So I think our political leaders are doing a pretty bad job right now in benefiting from the transition, which will happen sooner or later, to a clean energy and efficient economy.
As you look out at the broader landscape, and you're very, very fortunate to be working with campuses, because there is a lot of discussion. That's where people come to talk about new ideas, to express new visions, to share new ideas, that oftentimes it takes quite a while to reach into a more mainstream dialogue. Are there visions or models that you're finding interesting?
I think something that's begun to happen is that colleges are looking at holistic solutions to their emissions problems, and a lot of colleges are beginning to pass comprehensive climate plans and looking systematically at all of the emissions that they create. So they're beginning to identify local food sources to get their food from rather than importing it from abroad, and They're looking at how they invest their endowments and how students and faculty travel to and from the schools and within the school. Also looking at, you know, their buildings and their energy purchases. So that I think is exciting, and one of the reasons why I think colleges will be at the center of developing and building a movement is that they are really becoming innovators for sustainability.
How about people that perhaps haven't reached mainstream media currency, leaders, voices, spokespeople, writers, poets, musicians, who you think are making a difference or speaking the message that, that really resonates within your generation?
Yeah. Well, one of my personal heroes is Bill McKibben, who certainly has reached the mainstream in many ways, but he wrote a book that I just got 30 copies of and have been handing out called The Comforting Whirlwind. And, you know, really speaks to the values of our movement. He says that he believes that the secret weapon of environmentalism is that it's actually sort of creates a lifestyle that is more pleasurable than consumer-driven lifestyles that our government is promoting. And, you know, I think that that's really true and important for us to consider. There are also leaders like Jahan Giran and Anja Miller who work for the Environmental Justice and Climate Change Initiative, which is a national network of environmental justice groups that are, you know, represent communities that are the first and worst impacted by global warming, and they're sort of reframing the climate movement in terms of justice and rights and making it a moral issue, I think is really critical as well.
Now let's talk about you and your work and where you're really focused now and how you're reaching out. First of all, tell us what you're most involved in right now.
We just launched a campaign called the Campus Climate Challenge, which seeks to engage student groups at over 700 schools around the U.S. and Canada to try to make them models of sustainable communities, to sort of innovate new policies and model them for corporations, cities, other institutions. We did a soft launch of the campaign in October and have 166 campuses involved so far. And so we're supporting them with resources, case studies, helping plan conferences and trainings. We have toolkits for them. So all of that is available at campusclimatechallenge.org, and we're really trying to reach, you know, 500 more schools. So that's what we're working on now.
Mm-hmm. And that's becoming really your full-time endeavor, pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we also do as a coalition is we plan every, you know, twice a year, really, we plan days of action called, this one, there's one coming up called Fossil Fools Day, which is on April 1st. April 1st, you know, April Fools Day.
You know, I think I got that one, yeah. It's great, though, by the way. I just want to say I think it's a great... Oh, what am I trying to say here? There's so much messaging involved in those two words.
Yeah.
Fossil Fools Day. Or three words, actually. Fossil Fools Day. Well, let's talk about Fossil Fools Day. What's going to happen?
Well, you know, we're responding to President Bush's message that America is addicted to oil. And, you know, of course we are. And we've been saying that for a long time. And so, you know, we're glad that he said it, but the solutions that he proposed seemed sort of like a joke.
You mean like nuclear energy?
Yeah, nuclear energy, you know, more research. He's really not proposing solutions that are to scale with the problem. And, you know, in the 5 years that he's been in office, oil imports have increased by 8%. So he's been at the center of our oil addiction and has been, you know, one of the primary or probably the primary pusher of our oil addiction. For him to come out and say that is...
telling.
Yes, it's telling.
Right. The fact that, God bless him, he finally figured that out is at least encouraging.
It is slightly encouraging. Well, what we're trying to do with the day of action is to, you know, in a lighthearted and fun way, poke fun at him and other sort of fossil fools, and then promote real solutions. So, you know, we're talking about real fuel economy standard increases and, you know, transforming university transportation systems, investing in biofuels. So what we're trying to do is show how the solutions that Bush has proposed are false and that we really need real ones.
Well, now you have a lot of activities scheduled around the country. Give us, first of all, some highlights on what is happening.
Well, one of the most effective campaigns that our coalition has been involved in is called the Jumpstart Ford campaign. And the idea is that Ford has the lowest average fuel economy of any major automaker and, like GM, has been suffering and is economically and has had to lay off a number of workers. So we believe that it would be better for Ford and the country if Ford became a real innovator in fuel-efficient cars and trucks. They've begun to sell a few hybrids, but it's still only a very, very small percentage of their fleet. And so we're doing actions at dealerships all across the country, trying to get dealers to sign on to a letter to the company saying that they want the company to make more fuel-efficient cars. We had actions at 160 dealers last Fossil Fools Day. Ford was still a target back then, and we'll have a lot this year again. So that's a real highlight for me.
So if people want to find out what's happening in their community, what's the best way to do so?
They can check www.energyaction.net/fossilfools or jumpstartford.org.
How many people are you expecting to participate this Fossil Fools Day?
Well, we're expecting somewhere between 100 and 200 actions this Fossil Fools Day.
Mm-hmm.
We never know how many will come.
Let me ask you a question, and that's really kind of fun, and it is action, but it does take friendly action to sometimes, you know, bring about some sort of wake up call to people that otherwise may just go along with the status quo. Some people don't like that. And that's fine, too. It takes all kinds for change. That's one thing I'm well aware of.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about Ford? What do you think is, what is it? Why don't they get it when so many other car companies around the world are? You know, General Motors is about ready to lay off or retire 125,000 people. But that's a lot of people that suddenly lose their jobs. And it is so much because the cars themselves just aren't meeting what most everybody here is wanting. What do you think is behind this, behind Ford's inability? There's so many different angles to this, so many different stories about what causes this, but from your perspective, what do you think is the root?
Yeah, it's a complex thing, but I think that there are a couple things going on, one of which is that the government really isn't sending the proper signals. They aren't incentivizing making cleaner cars the way they should be. Another is that a lot of their profit margins, or they have much higher profit margins on the SUVs and the trucks that they sell. So it's still much more profitable for them to make SUVs than cars and trucks, although they could change that if they, you know, began to really innovate and make cars and trucks that people wanted to buy. I think a third, and maybe the biggest reason, is that a lot of these companies are stuck in a very short-term way of thinking. Because of their stock prices and, you know, investors are stuck in a quarterly reporting model that makes it harder for them to plan long term and, you know, invest in products that, you know, won't come down the line for a little bit longer, but might save the company in the long term.
As you look out into the future, I mean, what you're suggesting, and I totally agree, is the fact that there's this overemphasis on the short-term profitability with almost a total lack of real concern about the real issues. It's one thing to make short-term profits, but here's General Motors going down the tubes because they haven't taken a long-term vision, so ultimately profitability is destroyed. What are your hopes that somehow our system is going to integrate a more balanced approach to integrating economics and our resource bases and jobs? Do you expect that to happen? And if so, how do you think it might come about?
You know, I think it really is going to be on the government to do it. I think it'll take policies to change the way capitalism works. You know, I'm not confident that in the short term we will move to a system other than capitalism, but I think we need a government that really is working to address the problems that come out of the current economic model that we work in. And right now, it's, you know, government is sitting by and watching as these problems get worse. And so I think it'll take real political leadership, which we don't have very much of right now.
Well, Billy Parrish, I want to thank you, first of all, for lending your voice to the Wild Side News.
Yeah, happy to. Thanks, Sydney.
Yeah, and I wish you great success. And, you know, quite honestly, I'm happy you're involved because you bring a lot of hope to me when you suggest, for example, that on campuses people are really getting it. That's really great. That's
a huge movement is building. It's very exciting.
Billy Parrish, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Sydney.
Hope you enjoyed our Fools, Foundations, and Festivals features. There's so much happening around the planet, and there's no easier way to keep informed than by tuning in each Thursday or anytime on the archives. This is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.